Okay, so we'll start with the salutation to the Buddha.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa.
Okay, and today is July 14th, 2012. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, so now we start the summer term. And today we're taking sutta number 76 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Sandaka Sutta. It's the discourse to Sandaka. And this will be spoken by the Venerable Ananda to a wanderer by the name of Sandaka. And it takes place at Kosambi. That was a major city in the Buddha's time, in the park of the householder, established by the householder Rosita. Okay, so it starts off when Venerable Ananda, speaking to some of the monks, takes them to see a particular pool called Devakata Pool. And as they're walking to this pool, the wanderer by the name of Sandaka is sitting together with a large assembly of wanderers. And then this is a kind of stock description of whenever the wanderers of other sects have gathered together. They're always described as making an uproar, loudly and noisily talking, many kinds of pointless talk. And then it gives, I think there are 32, they're called 32 topics of pointless talk. Talk about kings, robbers, ministers, armies, dangers, battles, food, drink, clothing, beds, garlands, perfumes, relatives, vehicles, villages, towns, cities, countries, women, heroes, streets, wells, talk about the dead, trifling talk, talk about the origin of the world, the origin of sea, whether things are so or not so. Then the wanderer Sandaka saw the Venerable Ananda coming in the distance. Seeing him, he quiets his own assembly, and then he says, "Sirs, be quiet, make no noise. Here comes the recluse Ananda, a disciple of the recluse Gotama." Those venerable ones like quiet. They are disciplined and quiet. They commend quiet. Perhaps if he finds our assembly a quiet one, he will think to join us. Whenever I read this passage, having spent many years in Sri Lanka, I have to smile to myself. Why is this the case? If you spend time in Sri Lanka on what they call the Poya Day, the Uposatha Day, this is the day of the religious observance, generally it's the full moon day, starting about 5 a.m. in the morning, every temple has to have its loudspeaker. And so starting at 5 a.m. in the morning, you get coming from one direction, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato. Then they're hardly finished when coming from another direction, Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato. And they're hardly finished when coming from still another direction, Namo Tassa Bhagavata. And so you get coming from, you know, our hermitage was sort of on the hill, top of a hill, and so we would be exposed to the north, south, west, and east. Simultaneously, there would be this, they call it Piri chanting, the chanting of blessing sutras, coming from the four directions. Then throughout the whole day, there would be on the loudspeaker sermons being given, more piri chanting, more ceremonies, worship ceremonies. Goes right on, sometimes through the night. Everyone with their loudspeaker until maybe 2 a.m., 3 a.m. in the morning. Things quiet down. Yeah, so when I think about how the disciples of the ascetic Gotama are fond of quiet, disciplined and quiet, I think maybe that was the case 2,500 years ago. But today you need laws and regulations to keep them quiet. Okay, so when Nanda approaches the wanderer, Sandaka welcomes him, asks him to be seated. Okay, then after a little exchange, of courteous talk, then Sandaka asks Ananda whether he would give them a talk on the Dharma that he follows, the Dharma of the Buddha. Okay, so Ananda says that he's willing to do so, and then he starts to speak. And here Ananda is going to offer a very useful classification of 8 types of spiritual life, which were being propounded and expounded by different teachers during the Buddha's time. Sometimes people with a superficial knowledge of India in the Buddha's time think that on the one hand there were the Brahmins, and on the other hand the Buddha, or maybe the Buddha and the Jains who were opposed to the Brahmins. But actually, in India during the Buddha's time, there were two main, let's say, cultural centers of India. One main cultural center was located on, it's called the Kuru Plains, which is more in central northern India. It's an area that corresponds roughly to where Delhi is today. And in this area, and maybe a wide radius of which that area was the center, the Brahminic culture was dominant. But in East India, what is called the Ganges Plain, the area of the states of Magadha and Kosala belong to the same area, further to the north, the Brahmins didn't seem to be especially prominent. Brahminism was spreading to that area, and the Brahmins were increasingly making their influence and their point of view felt and listened to. But the dominant religious culture of that area centered around the Samanas. The Samanas were the ascetics who had left the household life for a life of renunciation, and they accepted and expounded a wide range of beliefs, philosophies, and practices quite different from that of Brahmanism. And so when the Buddha appeared on the scene, he lived primarily in the states of, well, first he came from the Sakyan Republic, which was pretty far in the northeast, and when he pursued his ascetic life, he descended downwards from the Sakyan state to the state of Magadha, where Bodh Gaya was located in the state of Magadha. And he had his main monasteries in the northeast, mainly in Rajagaha, which was the capital of the state of Magadha. That was the bamboo grove. And then further to the north in the state of Kosala, which had its capital in the city of Savati, and that was the Jetavana, Prince Jeta's grove, or the monastery that was established by Anathapindika. Kosambi, I believe, is still further to the west, but it still belongs to the, let's say, to the northeastern religious culture, rather than to the central Indian religious culture. Okay, and so when the Buddha was teaching, he not only expounded his own doctrine, but he also found it necessary, in a sense, to clear the field by pointing out the faults in other teachings. This is not for the purpose of, you know, knocking down other teachers, but for establishing the distinction, a clear distinction between, we call this a wrong understanding of the human condition and a right understanding of the human condition, between wrong views, right views, between views that lead to a dead end, or even worse, to kind of spiritual anarchy and nihilism, and views that are capable of leading to spiritual progress, to higher states of rebirth, to enlightenment, and to liberation. We find examples of this. Probably the most prominent example is the first sutta in the Dīgha Nikāya. This is called the Brahmajala Sutta, where the Buddha sets out a scheme of classifying the views in terms of 62 types of views, which include views about the past, views about the future. And then the second sutta in the Dīgha Nikāya, the Samanyapala Sutta, the discourse on the fruits of recluseship, begins with a long section which offers a kind of indirect critique of six teachers who were contemporary with the Buddha. And then in the Majjhima Nikaya, we also find sutta number 102, I think it is. It's called the 5 and 3, the Panchatthaya Sutta, which offers another scheme similar to that of the Brahmajala Sutta, but more concise, for classifying the different types of views that the Buddha rejected. In this sutta, Ananda develops a scheme, an eightfold scheme, that we don't find coming directly from the Buddha, but is based on principles that are clearly in accord with the Buddha's teachings. So here the Venerable Ananda is going to speak about, not so much in terms of philosophical, well, actually they do become philosophical views, but he speaks about ways, whole ways of spiritual practice, whole systems, which he classifies first into two main categories. One are called ways that negate the living of the holy life or the spiritual life. And then the second set are the kinds of holy life without consolation. That is, ways of spiritual life which one could practice. They're not self-contradictory, but they don't lead to liberation. So the ways that are not, that negate the living of the holy life, in Pali, it's the spiritual life or the holy life is brahmacharya. And vasa means dwelling or living. And then the is a negation. So these are ways that are negations of the living of the spiritual life. Then the word asasa means consolation. It literally comes from the word which means breathing in. Maybe breathing in like a... Well, we sigh, we breathe out when we sigh. But breathing in is a sign or indication of relief. And so when we get consolation, we can take a deep breath. But something which doesn't give consolation doesn't enable one to take that deep breath of relief. And so it's called anasasika, that which does not give consolation. And under each of these main headings, Ananda incorporates four ways, four teachings, four views with their corresponding ways of life. Some of these we've encountered before, but now we see them in a very neat and systematic method of classification. Okay, so Sandika first asks him to apply, to explain those four ways that negate the living of the holy life. It says, wherein a wise man or a wise person certainly would not live the holy life, or if he should live it there, then he would not attain the true way, the way to liberation, the Dhamma that is good and wholesome. So he would not be able to attain any kind of higher states of realization. So now Ananda begins his exposition, and the first type of negation of the spiritual life. And this is the case where a teacher holds this doctrine and view. He claims there is nothing given, nothing offered, nothing sacrificed. Of course, this doesn't mean that he's holding that, saying that giving something is an illusion. But what this means is that there is no point in giving, no merits in giving, in making offerings, in making... Well, sacrifice here in the religious context means acts of charity, of self-sacrifice. That there's no result, no fruit or result of good and bad actions. Whether one does good actions, bad actions, they don't produce any karmic results. There's no this world, no other world. Of course, he can't deny the existence of this world, but what he's saying is that there's no other life beyond this one. No world beyond this one. And so even this world that we're living in now is not part of, say, a larger cosmic process in which there is life in this world contrasted with life in other worlds and other realms. There's no mother, no father. Of course, this person knows that he has a mother and father, but what he means, or what is meant, is that there's no purpose in helping and serving, in supporting one's mother and father. You know, everybody is on his own. This is a world of stark competition where the strongest survive. So why look after one's mother or father? Just let them look after themselves. There's no beings who are reborn spontaneously. This refers to life in other realms. No good and virtuous recluses and Brahmins who have realized for themselves by direct knowledge the nature of this world and the other world and teach them to others. So, of course, this person will see that there are ascetics and Brahmins wandering about who claim to have higher realization, but he will say, oh, they're just deceiving themselves, they're just fools, you know, going around in these strange robes and shaving their heads or wearing long hair. And, you know, they make claims to realization, but the claims are all just bogus, all just humbug. There's nothing to them. Okay, so that's kind of the negative side of his position, which is that all the things that he denies, now he comes to enunciate the view that lies behind those negations, which is a view of what we could call materialism, philosophical materialism. So he holds that a person consists only of the four primary elements. So that means the only thing that's real, that's actual, is matter. So we can see that there was a kind of materialism already, philosophical materialism in the Buddha's time. So the person, of course, the person has a mind or a consciousness, but that mind is just an accidental byproduct of the play of material elements. And so what happens to consciousness when the body passes away? Okay, so when a person dies, the earth element in the body goes back to the earth. You know, the body disintegrates, turns to dust, and the dust of our body returns to the earth. The water of the body, you know, evaporates and returns to the moisture of the air. The heat of the body gets dispelled and just merges in the cosmic or the global heat. And the air of the body just returns to the atmosphere. The faculties, the sense faculties, pass over to space. And that's all. There's nothing surviving that. And so four men carry the coffin with the corpse inside. They carry it to the cremation ground. Then people give funeral orations. Oh, he was such a wonderful person. He benefited so many people. Oh, he lived such a worthy, noble life. You know, so as long as the body is on the funeral pyre, everybody is praising him, even though he might have been the village scoundrel, but somebody finds some good words to say about him. Then the bones whiten and the burnt offerings end with ashes. So nothing remains about this person. Nothing remains of this person but the ashes after the cremation. And so he asserts, giving, you know, is a doctrine of fools. It's the fools who praise giving. When anyone asserts the doctrine that there is some value in giving, generosity, observing ethical precepts, practicing meditation, and so on, all that is just nonsense, empty, false prattle. And the reason is because at death, whether one is a fool or a wise person, one is cut off and annihilated when the body perishes. And after death, nothing else exists. Everything comes to an end with the death of the body. So this is very much like modern materialism. And now Ananda is going to explain how a wise person reflects on this kind of teaching. So first he reconsiders the entire view. Then he thinks, if this good teacher's words are true, then both of us are exactly equal. We stand on the same level. Like he's setting up himself up as a teacher, a man of wisdom, and he's looking at me as a pupil. But, you know, if the fools and the wise are both cut off at death, how could he claim to be a wise person and think I have to learn something from him? We both have the same destiny at death. So we're both on the same level. I myself, who haven't practiced this teaching, and he who is practicing it, and so on. And then he goes on to sit to reflect that it's pointless or superfluous for this teacher to go about naked, to have a shaven head, to strive in this squatting posture, to pull out his hair and beard, since I, because this is a layperson who's reflecting, I live in a house full of children, I enjoy the various luxuries of life, and yet we'll both reap exactly the same destination, the same future course as this teacher. At death, we'll both be cut off and annihilated. So it seems from this passage, what we get the impression about the lifestyle of these teachers. Does the lifestyle seem to be consistent with their teaching?
No.
Yeah, it seems puzzling, doesn't it? One would think that a person who held that there was, you know, no survival of anything after death, no results of good and bad deeds, would be living the lifestyle of a, what's his name, the founder of Playboy, Hugh Hefner, or this guy who builds all the buildings in New York? Donald Trump. That would seem to be the lifestyle consistent with their view. But apparently, this is puzzling, at that time, even those who expounded doctrines like this, which are really radical, nihilistic doctrines, would still observe these even extreme ascetic practices. It's somewhat puzzling, and I don't know how to explain it. Maybe, this might be the explanation. Does anybody have any way to explain it, even if you just guess?
I think they see that as an auto-discipline in life to live better.
As a?
Self-discipline to live better.
But it would seem that they should have no... What do you mean by living better?
By being happy. That's the way they found to be happy, self-discipline.
I see. Perhaps so, but if they hold it, everything is cut off at death, one would think that they would just enjoy worldly pleasures. Richard?
Yeah, well,
maybe take the, you know, my announcement. Okay, now whoever gets the microphone uses it and then holds it till the next person raises their hand, and then the person with the microphone gives it to the next person chosen to speak. Okay, go ahead, Richard.
Yeah, there were Stoics and cynics who had this combination of views, and they generally would feel that they should be austere because they thought that unhappiness was caused by attachment to this life and by interest in the status system and in wealth and fame and power and so on. And so they thought that all of those concerns were foolish, and that people should abandon them, and that they were meaningless. Dogs live better, cynics thought. And so one should withdraw from society and have contempt for social forms and live this way, even though they didn't think they were going to live after death.
Oh,
and they
didn't
think that they were actually able to affect good deeds on other people.
Yeah. Actually, that goes quite consistently with the point you made. Barbara, did you have some? Wait, take the microphone. Is Barbara here up in, near the front?
I have a more cynical suggestion that in the society, it's probably true that somebody leading a renunciative life is going to have more status as a teacher.
Yeah, actually, that is true also.
People look to that as where wisdom is.
Yeah, that's a very good point, too. And there's another issue quite closely related to that came to my mind. Let's see if anybody else has that same thought. Okay, then I'll say what it is. It's actually very, very closely connected to that. That in order to live the life of a wandering teacher, they need material support. And so people will provide them with a simple hut if they want to live under a roof. They'll provide them with their food. If he's going naked, then of course he doesn't need any clothes. But maybe most of them didn't go naked, but they would wear simple robes. And so they would get some kind of material support because they were leading an ascetic life. if they just live as a householder, people will think, well, let him take the support himself by doing business or agricultural cultivation, but no need for us to support him. Then if he's working all day, tilling the fields or conducting his business, no chance to set out as a teacher. Okay, so anyway, this wise person in Ananda's view, as presented by Ananda, considers that there's no real, if we take that teacher's philosophy, there shouldn't be any significant difference between him and myself, the layperson living in a house with children, using the various luxuries of life. So then he considers what? It would make better sense to me if it read, what does this teacher know and see that I should leave the holy life under this teacher? So then when he finds that this way negates the living of the holy life, he turns away from it and leaves it. Okay, so that's the first type of negation of a spiritual life that a wise person rejects. Okay, then we come to, and this view, when it comes down in the text, it's often called Natthikavada. Yeah, the word nati means there is not. And so this is the doctrine of there is not. So it's the there is not means there is no giving, no observing of precepts, no point in supporting mother and father and so on. Okay, the second view goes by the name Akiryavada, which means the doctrine, literally the doctrine of non-doing, or the doctrine of non-activity. And this is, again, it's a quite morally pernicious view, since it holds that when one acts or makes others act, I think the implication here is when one acts for the harm of others or makes others act, when one mutilates others or gives commands to others to mutilate, when one tortures or makes others inflict torture, when one inflicts sorrow and so on, oppresses others, intimidates, when one kills living beings, steals the wealth of others in various ways, seduces the wife of others, utters falsehood, one does not do anything evil. And so if with a razor-rimmed wheel one were to go around and make all the living beings on this earth just one mass of dead flesh, one heap of flesh, one would not be committing any evil, and there would be no outcome of evil. If one person were to go on the south bank of the river Ganges, killing and slaughtering and so on, he would not commit any evil, and there would be no outcome of evil. And if one were to go along the north bank of the river Ganges, making gifts and encouraging others to give, making offerings and so on, because of this, there would be no merit and no outcome of merit. By giving, by self-training, by restraint, by speaking truth, there is no merit and no outcome of merit. This view seems, I have to say, it seems very similar to the first one. Now, I don't really understand the clear distinction between them, but it seems that the key point in this view would be the denial of the validity of moral distinctions, ethical distinctions. The key point in the first view seems to be that there is no creation of karma which is going to exert its effect beyond death. It would seem that the second view has the same implication as well, so that's why I don't quite understand or grasp the difference between them. But if anybody else has any thoughts about that, please feel welcome to speak. Okay, Richard, you take the microphone. Yeah, just pass it back.
The first one is neutral, whereas the second one is negative. It's like the second one is seeking to prove that there are no consequences, that there's no difference between morality and immorality by proving that there are no consequences to oneself for immoral acts.
That's the second view or the first?
The second. That is, you see, Periyar, for instance, who was the atheist in Tamil Nadu, used to go to Brahmin temples and break the statuary intentionally because he wanted to demonstrate that there was no ill effect for himself. And he lived to be 101. And
What is his name again?
Periyar. Periyar. He was a prominent atheist. And he got an enormous following because people felt liberated from Brahmanism because of his demonstrations. Now, this isn't quite like that. His point is somewhat different. He acted as this one. It goes a lot further. It's actually injuring people and showing that there isn't any ill effect. Whereas the first one has a posture of neutrality. It's like, you know, okay, you can't really do anything. It's not saying it's good to do evil to other people. Mm. It's saying that it doesn't do any good to do good to other people.
Mm. It's
denying that there's a real relationship between other people, so that one person cannot benefit from another's good deeds on the transfer of merit.
Yeah. Okay. And I guess one would have to be something of a... Well, I think presentations of these views don't come to us anywhere else except in the Buddha suttas, because even the early Jain teachings were not written down until several centuries after the Buddha scriptures were written down. So we don't have any other key to the teachings of these philosophers. The Vedas don't mention them at all, I believe.
Yeah, the second one really isn't so strange. There are people like this in India now. There were whole castes of criminals. I mean, there were criminal castes in the 1800s, the British banned. There was a guy who committed 720 some murders in western Tamil Nadu in the forests, who was a kind of folk hero in the way that Jesse James was a folk hero here. That is particularly when
that was in quite recent, the last few decades.
The thing is, when people feel oppressed by the government and by upper castes and so on, they often make heroes of people who take revenge on them. Mm. You know, it's kind of like, you know, good riddance to all those people. They deserved it.
In later centuries, there did come a sect within Hinduism, kind of related to the Tantra, to Tantrism, which held that an enlightened person could commit any kind of transgressive action without incurring any kind of sin or unwholesome karma.
Yeah, the Anabaptists held that doctrine in the 1500s also in Germany. The Anabaptists.
The Anabaptists.
Yeah.
Okay. In the Samanyapala Sutta, these two views are associated with different philosophers who are contemporary with the Buddha. The view of nihilism or materialism was associated with the teacher by the name of Ajita. Kesa Kamba or Kambali. Ajita was his actual name. Kesa Kambali means that he wraps himself in a blanket made out of hair, the hair of the head. So apparently he gets people to cut off their hair and he weaves that hair together to make a kind of blanket or a shawl in which he wraps himself because it's uncomfortable, and so it's a kind of ascetic practice. Whereas the view of a Kiryavada is associated with a teacher by the name of Spurana Kassava. Okay, then the wise person, again, he applies the same kind of reflection to this teaching, and he realizes that there's no point in trying to live a spiritual life based on this philosophy, because the principles of this philosophy undermine the very meaning of a spiritual life. Okay, the third view is called, technically it's called a Hetukavada, which means the view that denies causality, causation. And this teacher proclaims that there is no cause or condition for the defilement of beings. Beings are defiled without cause or condition. There is no cause or condition for the purification of beings. Beings are purified without cause or condition. So this teacher is holding that the ideas of purification and defilement are meaningful, but there's no causation behind them. Nothing to abstain from and avoid to escape defilement. Nothing to practice and cultivate in order to purify oneself. And so he continues, there is no power, no energy, no manly strength or human strength, no human endurance. And the reason, here comes the reason for this view, that all beings, all living things, all creatures, all souls are without mastery, power, and energy. They are molded by destiny, circumstance, and nature. And they experience pleasure and pain in the six classes. They have a theory of six classes of living beings. And the main point in this theory is that all beings are driven by destiny, circumstance, and nature. In other words, that there's a fixed destiny at work behind the fate of all beings. And so the reason why some are born rich, others poor, some have well-developed intelligence, others are dull-minded, some have good opportunities for advance in life, others have poor opportunities. This is all because of destiny, fate, or nature. And, you know, it's like the moment we're born, our destiny is already written on our horoscope, and whatever we can do, we cannot escape our destiny. If the cards say that were destined to be assassinated in Paris on August 23rd, 2013. You know, I might make it a resolution. I'm not going to go to Paris on August 23rd, 2013. And so I'm driving through the Midwest and stop at a little gas station to fill my gas tank. Some crazy man comes at me, shoots me, I die, and I didn't know it, but the little town where I stopped to fill my gas is called Paris, Iowa. You know, so you can't escape destiny. Okay, and then in the Digha Nikaya, this view is associated with Makkali Gosala, but interestingly, in the Samyutta Nikaya, this view is ascribed to Purana Kassapa. So it seems that even within the Buddhists, amongst the Buddhists, within the different lines of textual transmission, there was some confusion about which view was being propagated by which teacher. But you see that if this view is true, then there's no point really to be living a life of spiritual self-cultivation, because I might be, you know, observing full set of precepts, the precepts of a monk. You know, I might be meditating 8 to 10 hours a day. Another person might be breaking all of the precepts and just enjoying life to the full. And yet, if it's his destiny to gain enlightenment, whereas my destiny is to gain enlightenment after 10,000, his destiny is to get enlightenment in this life itself, my destiny is to get enlightenment after 10,000 lives in the future, and no point for me to strive so diligently. You know, I could just sit back, enjoy myself, and wait for the 9,999 lives to go by, and then in the 10,000th life, I'll get enlightened. And this guy, he can enjoy himself, and he'll be enlightened in this life itself. Maybe it just occurred to me that maybe a contemporary proponent of the second view here would be somebody like, does the name Charles Manson still mean anything to anybody? I don't know whether people have forgotten him or those of the younger generation never heard that name. But he was the leader of a cult in, was it the Los Angeles area? In the late 1960s, he had like a band of followers. And they sort of had absorbed little bits and pieces of Eastern philosophy. And I think that they were taking some of these drugs, like psychedelic drugs. And then they developed the philosophy that, you know, they could commit any kind of crimes with impunity. It doesn't matter that they wouldn't be doing anything wrong. It would just be, you know, expressing the natural order of things. And it's the fault of the victim that they were destined to be killed anyway. So as murderers, they're just acting as the agents of destiny. And so they went around, they killed a famous actress. What's her name? Sharon Tate? Did they kill anybody? Some other people too, I think they killed.
4 or 5 people.
Yeah. Very brutally too. And then when he was brought to trial, Charles Manson, he had these sort of wide open eyes, this bushy beard, and he would say, like, everything's groovy, man, everything's cool anyway, you know, everything's in order, just groove with it, man. You know, nothing matters, good or bad. It's all the same. Okay, now we come to the fourth view. This view, there's no special name for it, at least I'm not aware of any name. But in the text, it's connected with somebody named Pakuda Kachayana. Maybe you just call it conveniently the seven bodies group, the seven bodies doctrine. By body here, what he means is like, we call it constituent elements, or fundamental components of the world. So this teacher holds the view that there are seven components or constituents of the world, which are unmade, not created, without a creator. They are always existing eternally. They're like the seven permanent elements or components of the world. So everything arises from the combination of these elements, but the elements themselves are uncreated and eternal. So they do not move or change or obstruct each other. And no one is able to produce pleasure, pain, or pleasure and pain in another. So what are these seven elements? There's the earth, what's called the earth body, the water body, the fire body, the air body. Those are the four primary material elements. Then he recognizes pleasure and pain, two types of feeling. And then the seventh constituent is the soul. So there's the eternal soul, which unites with this combination of the eternal physical elements, and that constitutes a living being. And as a consequence, he goes on to say, there is no killer, no slaughterer, no hearer, speaker, cognizer, and so on. So even if one cuts off somebody else's head with a sharp sword, one does not deprive anyone of life. The sword merely passes through the space between the seven elements. Or maybe we would say that the sword merely severs the connection between the soul and the material body. So the soul will go off to rebirth elsewhere. It remains permanent and unchanging. And the material elements of the body still remain eternally remain forever, though no longer connected with that soul. So it doesn't really matter if one kills anybody, because one doesn't. Let's say it doesn't matter if we, as convention puts it, we kill somebody, because ultimately nobody and nothing is killed. The soul just lasts forever and just goes on to a new body. Does anybody know of any religious work where we find a resonance of this view? Very famous, important religious work. Yeah.
It's very similar to the Bhagavad Gita.
Exactly, exactly.
But the Bhagavad Gita doesn't deny there's no karma.
Yeah, that is so. Yeah.
This seems like a defilement of that teaching.
Yeah, except of course the Bhagavad Gita teaching probably comes several centuries, or at least in writing it comes several centuries later. But the Bhagavad Gita uses the argument that because the soul, the Atman, is eternal, that Krishna tries to persuade his pupil Arjuna that he could go into battle and kill the people in the battle, because the soul itself is eternal, everlasting, and won't die. But this doesn't mean that the Bhagavad Gita upholds a kind of moral anarchy. It seems almost that that's kind of a rhetoric that Krishna uses to persuade Arjuna to fulfill his duty as a kshatriya, as a warrior. Yeah, you going, Richard?
The
the oddity of that work is that it's actually the losers are more moral than the winners. That is, Arjuna is on the winning side, but the most heroic and the most genuine characters are actually people who are killed off by Arjuna's family, right? And part of what Arjuna is being told is, look, it doesn't matter. You are predestined to win. You have to win, because even though they are individually better than you are, this is the side you were born into. This is, what you want. And so it's a caste-bound book. And it's very curious that, for instance, Gandhi regarded the Bhagavad Gita as a pacifist text.
Yeah, exactly.
That certainly isn't. And I think that he was reading it the way that he read it because his tutors were Jains, not Hindus.
Yeah.
But like Rabindranath Tagore, who was raised as a Hindu, does have that kind of doctrine. So like, he has poems that say things like the tree invites the axe man to chop it down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the tree makes space for the axe to bite into its flesh.
Okay, anyway, then this is followed in the text by a long, strange cosmology. I don't want to go into the details of that. But just we could see, what is the main point of this teaching comes towards the end, going down about three quarters of the way, he says there are 8,400,000 great aeons wherein, by running and wandering through the round of rebirths, fools and the wise both will make an end of suffering. In other words, that there's like a fixed period of cycling through the round of rebirths, and then when one reaches the end of that, then one gets liberated, whether one is wise or foolish. And so there's no point in observing any kind of virtue or observance or asceticism, because pleasure and pain are meted out, the round of rebirths is limited, there is no shortening it, no extending it, no increasing it, no decreasing it. Then he uses the simile of a ball of string. When you hold on one end of the thread of the string and throw the ball just keeps on unwinding until all of the string has unwound, and then that's the end of the ball of thread. And so in the same way, fools and the wise, they each have their predestined time to wander through this round of rebirths. And when they go through these 84,000 aeons, then they make an end of suffering. Okay, so again, the wise person reflects that it's pointless to lead the spiritual life under this kind of teaching. Okay, so these are the four ways that negate the living of the spiritual life. Then Sandaka expresses his appreciation, and he asks Ananda to go further and to explain the four ways of the four kinds of holy life that are without consolation, that have been spoken of by the Buddha. And this picks up on page 623, section 21. Okay, the first view is, and then there's a rather pointed attack taking place here. Ananda says, some teacher claims to be omniscient and all-seeing, to have complete knowledge and vision, no matter what he's doing all the time, uninterruptedly. He has this omniscience, omniscient knowledge. And yet, when he goes on alms round, he might enter an empty house. He thinks somebody is living there, he goes into the house and it's empty. If he was omniscient, he should have known not to go into that house. And so he gets no alms food there, or he goes down a street where a dog bites him, he meets with a wild elephant, a wild horse, a wild bull. If he was omniscient, he should have known to avoid that area. He has to ask about the name or the clan of a person, the name of a village or town. And then if somebody tries to, you know, point out that this contradicts his claim to omniscience, then he says, well, I had to enter the empty house, that's why I entered it. I had to get no alms food, that's why I didn't get any. I had to be bitten by the dog, that's why I was bitten, and so on. And so he tries to ascribe all of that to some kind of predestination. Does anybody know who is being parodied in this section? There's a specific rival of the Buddha. Now, this is Mahavira, the historical founder, or at least the best-known teacher of Jainism. Also, you have Mahavira. In the Buddhist text, he's known as Nikanta Nataputta. And sometimes I have to say, I wonder whether the Buddhist texts really correctly represent the Jain position. One gets the feeling, you know, when the Buddha is criticizing the Brahmins, he's still in a way respectful of the Brahmins and tries to give them as much room, as much leeway as he can. But when the Buddhist texts are speaking about the Jains, the tone almost becomes a bit caustic and mocking, ridiculing.
Yeah, I think there are two reasons for that. One, he's living in a Brahminical society in which he's in danger if he isn't complimentary to the Brahmins. And secondly, the Jains were his closest competitors, and frequently vituperation between people or groups with very similar views, but a few exceptions, is a lot sharper because they both seek to emphasize the differences between them because they're competing for the same space.
I'm not so much, as I said at the beginning, I'm not sure of the extent to which the Brahmins exerted strongly powerful positions in the northeast of India at that time.
In the area that the Buddha was raised in, what's now southern Nepal, and that the caste system was probably looser there. But I think that in the Ganges Basin itself, it was at its strongest.
From what I've read, even in the Ganges Basin, the class system had not yet been as well established as it was. Well, let's say it had been established, but the Brahmins were not in the dominant position that they held in the central and western parts of India. But certainly the second reason that you give, that there seems to have been like it's reluctant to use the word, but a certain degree of competition between the Buddhist community and the Jain community. Katie.
So just to be clear then, at the outset, I think you said the suttas preserve this, or they might not preserve it, they might sort of create this, where that level of speech or this particular angle of harshness, you started this by saying something, you think the suttas may almost embellish on the tone or the antagonism there. I don't remember the verb, I apologize, but you said,
I question whether they always represent the opponent's position correctly.
Right. That's a good point then, and I wonder how Gautama would have actually addressed this versus students who are not Buddhists following and attempting to record this. If students have more flaws coming through in efforts to record the dialogue, more of their personal hindrances, whereas Gautama's own efforts in this area might have been
more. I mean, it's possible that these kind of representations come in through later generations, but we don't have any way to know for sure. But there are suttas in which the Buddha never meets Mahavira face to face. They never have a discussion between them. But one does see suttas where the Buddha meets followed disciples of Mahavira and engages them in discussions.
So I guess my thing would be Gautama, if one trusted his genius that lives on through history, it wouldn't serve him to misrepresent his opponent. It would serve him to represent his opponent perfectly well, and therefore if something like this is misrepresented in Jainism, that would be one way of saying maybe this is expression of students who are not as...
That was so, yeah, yeah. And I don't know enough about Jainism to be able to say to what extent he's representing Jainism correctly, especially the Jainism in the period in which the Buddha lived, because we don't have scriptures that actually come down from that period. The Jain scriptures record the position of Jainism several centuries later. Okay, so anyway, this becomes the first reason why... You see, this type of position, it doesn't negate the possibility of a spiritual life, but the spiritual life is unsatisfactory because the teacher makes a claim to omniscience, and yet that claim is belied by aspects of his behavior. And so one can't place full trust in that teacher. Okay, then the second position, this is the position pretty much of the Brahmins. This is on paragraph 24. Some teacher is a traditionalist, one who regards oral tradition as truth. And he teaches the Dharma by oral tradition, by the legends handed down, by the authority of the collections. Okay, so this is the way the Brahmins transmitted their teaching, by oral transmission from teachers to students. The Vedas were transmitted by memorization from generation to generation, and they were always accepted on the authority of the ancient rishis, the ancient sages who were supposed to have received the Vedas by a kind of divine revelation and then passed them down through a lineage of sages. But the Buddha points out that when a teacher is a traditionalist, some of his teachings will be well transmitted, and some teachings will be badly transmitted. Some will be true, and some will be false. And so this kind of spiritual life is without consolation. The third position is the position of, we would call them rationalists. So this is the case, paragraph 27, where the teacher is a reasoner, somebody who works just with logical reasoning. So he teaches his Dharma, which has been hammered out by reasoning, following a line of inquiry according to his own intuition as it occurs to him. So this is a teaching not based on a higher level of realization and attainment, but a purely intellectual or philosophical system, such as we find mostly in Western philosophy. Okay, so when a teacher is a reasoner or a rationalist, some of his teachings will be well-reasoned and others will be wrongly reasoned, some true, some otherwise. And so one doesn't want to lead the spiritual life under, say, Immanuel Kant or George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel or Bertrand Russell or somebody who's works purely at the intellectual level, because they wouldn't be able to guide one to an experiential realization of higher truth. And so one doesn't, that kind of holy life is without consolation. And then we come to the fourth type of teaching. This is paragraph 30. Again, I think there's a little bit of parody taking place here. This is a teacher, he's described as somebody who's dull and confused. And because he's dull and confused, when he is asked such and such a question, he engages in verbal wriggling, in what's called eel wriggling, because the eel just swims around like this. And if you try to catch the eel with the hands, it will slip out of the hands. So this is the kind of person that you can't pin down to a definite position. So if you ask him, is it like this? He'll say, I don't say it is like this. I don't say it's like that. I don't say it's otherwise. I don't say it's not so. I do not say it's not not so. And it seems that this is a position similar to that of the skeptics, you know, those who refuse to make definite commitments on any of these key philosophical questions. And it could be that these skeptics, even in the part of India where the Buddha lived, could have really been quite intelligent and quite sharp-witted, and they could have understood that all of these positions have built-in contradictions, and so if one takes any fixed stand, it can be undermined by some hidden flaw within that position itself. And so for this reason, they might have refused to make definite statements or to have taken definite positions. But it seems that kind of sarcastic or pejorative way, the text is describing that teacher as dull and confused. Does that seem to be the case, Richard? You know the skeptics of Greece?
Well, there are a couple of different versions. One, the schools of the academy, that is the school founded by Plato, after, you know, like 100 years after Plato's death, was held generally by other people to be occupied by skeptics who refused to take any particular position but would simply refute all other positions. That is that stance. Somewhat different from Puritanism. Puritanism is more, that is the position of Septus and Puritus. It's sort of closer, I think, to the Buddhist stance, which is that it's a kind of bracketing process later used by the phenomenologists and also the source of Hume's kind of skepticism, right, and empiricism, which is that basically the abstract statements shouldn't be taken seriously because there isn't a persistent self, which, for instance, Hume adopted from them and so on, and that it isn't necessary to lead a good life to have any positive doctrine. But they were regarded as quite different positions, I imagine, because they were actually presented differently in character. The people were quite different. From the distance,
they look pretty similar. Okay, do we have any questions on anything that has been covered so far? Okay, Tracy.
The popular historian of religion, Karen Armstrong, wrote a biography of the Buddha for a general audience, and she portrays the scene at the time of the Buddha's teaching, which I kind of get from this, that it was a time of restlessness and search. And that going forth would almost be, can't think of a parallel today, like looking for a solution to the environmental problem. That is it the case that it was a time of restlessness and general stagnation and an inordinate number of teachers popping up as she portrays?
Oh yeah, definitely that seems to be the case from the wide variety of views we find here in the Brahmajala Sutta, because the old sort of agrarian, primarily agrarian society was being transformed by the rapid expansion of cities, and then the old political system of small states was being transformed by the emergence of large, powerful monarchies, which were big fish were swallowing up the little fish and absorbing these small states into themselves and then turning into expanding monarchies, which were clashing with one another, and then wars were taking place. And new value, as this society was becoming more mercantile, new values were supplanting the old values, coming down from the Vedic period. So it was a time of transitional period of great social, economic, political transformation. Okay, I just want to go rather quickly through the rest of the sutta. So now we have the four types of spiritual life that are without consolation, Then Ananda explains the spiritual life wherein a wise man certainly would live the holy life, and by living it would attain the true way, the Dhamma that is wholesome. And then Ananda explains the gradual training of the Buddha, starting from the Buddha's appearing in the world, then the training of the disciple, the elimination of the five hindrances, the attainment of the four jhanas, the achievement of the three higher knowledges, up to the liberation of the mind from the taints, and the attainment of liberation from birth and death. That's paragraph 50, which ends with the attainment of arahatship. Then Santika will ask Ananda two questions, actually several questions, but one is, the first one is, whether when one becomes an arhat, completely liberated through final knowledge, one could enjoy sensual pleasures. And the question seems to be asking whether an arhat could indulge in sexual enjoyment, in sexual intercourse. But Ananda's reply takes a somewhat different track. He says that when a monk is an arhat who has destroyed the taints, he is incapable of transgression in five cases. He's incapable of deliberately depriving a living being of life, incapable of stealing or taking what is not given. He's incapable of indulging in sexual intercourse. He's incapable of false speech, deliberately speaking falsehood. Then the fifth is that he is incapable of enjoying sensual pleasures by storing them up as he formerly did in lay life. And what this means, it doesn't mean that he's storing up a entourage of beautiful women to enjoy, but it means that the arhat is incapable of storing up foodstuffs to enjoy on later days. Of course, the sort of the paradigm for the arhat in the Buddha's time was that of the monastic disciple who lives on alms given by others. And so he'll collect enough food to support himself or maybe some of the fellow monks just for that day. Then the next day he'll be open to receive new offerings from others. But actually in the Buddha's time it became obligatory to have some way of storing food because the monasteries would be offered more food than they need. So a system was worked out of having a storage area where foodstuffs can be stored, and the responsibility for maintaining the store area would fall to a lay disciple who lives at the monastery. He's like a monastery attendant or a steward of the monastery. So if the monks are given raw foodstuffs to use for preparing meals, then the steward would take them, put them in the storage area, and take responsibility for preparing them for the monks. Okay, so this is the first question. The second question, this is an interesting point. Santika asks whether an arhat is always, continuously, and uninterruptedly aware that his taints are destroyed, that he is free from the taints. Then Ananda answers him with a rather bizarre simile. He says, suppose there were a man whose arms and feet had been cut off. Would he be continuously and uninterruptedly aware that his arms and feet have been cut off, whether he's sleeping or awake? And the answer is that he wouldn't be aware of this, but he would be aware of this only when he reflects on his condition. And so it's the same with the arahat. He doesn't have this knowledge and vision that his taints are destroyed continuously and uninterruptedly present to him all the time, even when sleeping. But rather, it's only when he reflects back on that fact that he knows my taints are destroyed. So all the time his taints are destroyed, but he's not always aware of that fact. It's not always present to him consciously. Okay, then Sandika asked the Buddha, right? I'm not sure that this translation is correct. I would translate it now, how many emancipated ones are there in this Dhamma and discipline? How many have achieved emancipation in this teaching? Then Ananda says, there are not only 100, 200, 300, 400, 500, but even far more emancipated ones in this Dhamma and discipline. Okay, so when Sandika hears this, then he's delighted. He says, it's wonderful, it's marvelous. Then he adds that there is no praising of one's own Dhamma and no disparaging of the Dhamma of others, but there is the teaching of the Dhamma in its full range. I guess that range would be from all of the stages of the disciple's cultivation, from undertaking the moral precepts to the attainment of arhatship. So there would be the teaching of the Dhamma in its full range, and there would be so many emancipated ones. Then he says, but these ajivakas, the ajivakas, this was another school contemporary with the Buddha, which was under the leadership of Makkali Gosala. They laud themselves and disparage others, and they recognize only three emancipated ones, namely Nandavacha, Kisa Sankicha, and Makkali Gosala. We don't know very much about Nandavacha and Kisa Sankicha, but Makkali Gosala was this teacher, contemporary with the Buddha, who is regarded historically as the founder of the Ajivakas, a sect which continued in India for many centuries, I think down to about the 15th century. Okay, when, after Sandika makes this declaration, then he turns to his own followers and he says, go, sirs, live the spiritual life under the recluse Gotama. So he's sending his own followers away to become disciples of the Buddha. But he says, it's not easy for me now to give up gain, honor, and renown. Seems because he's a highly regarded teacher, he's not willing himself to give up his position as a teacher and then become a disciple of the Buddha. But it's a little puzzling. He recognizes the superiority of the Buddha's teaching, and so he sends his own followers to become disciples of the Buddha. I would think that if he were really wise, he would have, and humble, he would have given up his attachment to his position as teacher and become a disciple of the Buddha. Okay, so that's the end of the sutta. Any questions or comments? Our time is running short, so we have to. Allison?
Yeah, I have one question.
Maybe take the microphone.
I'm just curious about the last sentence you said. You were wondering why he decided to dissemble his home,
his disciples.
Right, he sent his disciples to Buddha's God. Ascend,
yep.
But he will not go. Yeah. I'm just wondering, is it pride, one of the five aggregates? How do we, this is nothing to do with Ascend, but the most difficult one that I have found is the pride.
Yeah.
And for this lesson, I'm just wondering how, as a lay person,
yeah,
we can work on that.
Work on pride.
Right.
Yeah. sometimes it's good deliberately to do things wrongly, a little stupidly, a little clumsily, so other people will criticize you, and then it helps to knock down one's pride. But otherwise, one could contemplate the five aggregates as being not mine, not I, not myself. Or when one does doing something that's excellent and outstanding, one just reflects, not I, not mine, not myself. And then that will help to diminish pride. We could discuss that more after lunch, but time is running out, so I just want to make two brief announcements. One is that today at 2 p.m. there will be a lecture in the library on the topic of mindfulness and health by a lecturer from Taiwan who has a doctorate from Australia, Wan Zhong Guan, is that his name? Gwen, right? So, if you have the time, and please come for that. The other is, I don't like to do this for self-promotion, but I want to save you some money. That my translation of the Anguttara Nikaya, which I completed all the work on about a little more than a week ago, it's scheduled for publication from Wisdom Publications for the fall, but Wisdom Publications is offering a special pre-publication discount. If you order it before August 15th, you can get it at a 40% discount off the list price. So it will be $45. It's 1,950 pages, something like that. And it's a hardback, nicely printed, produced hardback.
Is it likely that you will teach from that?
Maybe.
They also send a PDF, a substantial PDF preview.
You get it, the preview?
Yeah.
I haven't gotten it.
Because I asked, I said, how can you give a preview if he's not done proofing? But they send a really substantial preview. It's not a small section.
Yeah, they send the preview if you get submit the advance order. And the advance order also covers free postage, and they'll send it directly from the press to your address. So if you're interested, please don't wait until after August 15th, but place the order now. Okay, so I'm just going to do a very, very quick sharing of the merits. And then we'll come back at, say, 12:15, and then have some discussion. I'm going to do this in really fast style. Akasa ta chabuma ta devanagam hedika panyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasa ta chabuma ta devanagam hedika panyantam anumodipa chiram rakantu desanam. Akasa ta chabuma ta. Deva Naga Mahidika Panyantam Anumodipa Chiram Rakantu Mangaram Eta Vidacha Mehi Sampadang Punya Sampadang Sabe Deva Anumodantu Sabe Bhutanumodantu Sabe Satanumodantu Sabha Sampati Siddhya Bhavagupadaya Vichyetato E tantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanyino dukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhuti. Okay, we do end with the three vows. And next week we'll have a class on sutta number 77, which is a pretty dense sutta, so I have to take it over several weeks. And this is really very rich in including many different aspects of the Buddha's teaching that we'll elaborate on.
self-abundant.